It's 11:06.
This is the Film Week Hour of Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio, and online at kpcc.org. In our second half hour, we will review the week's new releases, but in this half hour, we want to discuss the new documentary, Black Magic. It's a film that tells the story of the injustice which characterized the civil rights movement in America as told through the lives of basketball players and coaches who attended historically black colleges and universities. Earl the Pearl Monroe is a co-producer and one of the basketball legends profiled in the film. Also, Wynton Marsalis, Samuel L. Jackson, and Chris Paul are the narrators. Black Magic is a four-hour, two-part film scheduled to be telecast primetime on Sunday, March 16th and Monday, March 17th on ESPN. It is directed and produced by award-winning filmmaker Dan Kloris, who joins us to talk about the film. Dan, thanks for coming on Film Week.
My pleasure. Good to speak to you.
You talk about how one of the big reasons you wanted to tell the story is that it's essentially been ignored by historians and sports writers, and I'm wondering why you think that is, and do you believe there's just a general reluctance to kind of acknowledge that part of history when there was so much discrimination and racism?
Yeah, well, yes, of course, I believe that, and you put it well, a general reluctance, but there's also a lack of data and information and reporting. The overwhelming outlet for reporting of the accomplishments of anything that had to do with not merely historical black colleges, but with the black community in America, with the old black newspapers, and as they that's where people looked for news, be it national, be it local. So the newspapers in what we call the majority community didn't report on these games, on these players, and therefore they remained a secret, basically a secret.
Is that because these newspapers didn't think the public was interested, or was it just blatant discrimination on the part of the papers as well?
I think it depending on where, you know, both of those things. I mean, clearly, there was an attitude in many places, with some subconscious desires, and others with a blatant desire to ignore any good news, any achievements about black people. You know, I mean, that's what interested me in this. That because I started doing this, I started researching a project that was going to do a 20-hour, 10-part film on basketball, like Burns had done on baseball. I got the green light from ESPN.
To do 20 hours,
and I started getting bored with it. I researched it for about a year and a half, and I really said to myself, I don't want to really live my life, you know, for 5 years doing this. But the one thing that pulled me was every time I kept on reading about historical black colleges. And I grew up in New York, but lived in the South for 10 years from the late 60s to the 70s. And even then, didn't know much about them. We know we refer to them as the black schools, not knowing anything about their origins, anything about their history, anything about what they meant and mean to their student body, faculty, or the relationships within, let alone sport. Not much on it. Therefore, I was interested.
We're talking to Dan Kloris. He's the director and producer of Black Magic, a new film documentary that's going to air on ESPN on Sunday and Monday. If you'd like to ask a question or talk to him, please give us a call at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. We'd especially like to hear from those who attended historically black colleges and perhaps attended during the time that's covered in this documentary, which covers many of the legends.
Well, no one's going to be around for Reconstruction.
Well, maybe more recent history, maybe the Al Attles or Willis Reed or Earl the Pearl Monroe era, which you profile in the film. And it's called like A Story of Injustice, Refuge, and Joy. And obviously right. The injustice part is apparent, but where's the refuge and the joy in this piece?
Thank you for asking. The university was the refuge, as well as the game. as well as the game. The it's a film about exclusion and therefore invention. And when you are excluded from the mainstream, what do you do to invent, to move along, to move forward, sometimes to assimilate? And after forms of worship came this idea of education. And blacks were banned from being educated. Many instances was against the law. Let us form our own schools. Out of Reconstruction came this idea of historical black colleges, both by state legislatures and by churches. So you begin to have even a pecking order within schools. Some are geared towards following the philosophy of Du Bois, some the philosophy of Booker T. That and within those campuses, those environments, it's a safer world. That's the refuge. That's the refuge. And the game, or as all games, as all forms of leisure activity, that escape is a psychological refuge also. Interesting thing. I'd interview guys like Earl Lloyd or Ben Jobe or John Cheney. They would refer to the schools in the female pronoun, her. So it caught my ear after one or two times. I'd say, well, why do you use the female pronoun? And they'd say, because these schools nurture you, man. Mothers nurture you.
Interesting.
Fathers don't nurture you. Now, that's a feeling that I don't think many people outside of historical black colleges and their university relationships feel at all, you know? So that's a long way of answering your where does the refuge come from? And the joy, of course, is the achievements. The achievements of making the team, of playing, of coming to school, of getting the degree, of learning to of making a decision whether we want to be part of a protest, of a sit-in or not. How do we contribute? Of hitting the big jumper to win a national championship. At the same time, it goes back to exclusion. The great coach John McClendon, who's the focal point of the film, in the late 1950s, his teams at Tennessee A&I won three consecutive national championships with Dick Barnett as his star player. And they were, but in the NAIA conference, they weren't allowed to participate in the NCAA. There's a letter in the film from the head of the NCAA to McClendon, a letter saying, Your schools aren't good enough, which was untrue.
John McClendon and Clarence Big House Gaines,
that's
you
right.
Profile as two of the fathers, if you will, of basketball, especially at historically black colleges, and that McClendon created the fast break and the four corners offense. You talk about the two of them combined, their impact on the game that
McClendon
we know today.
Was first, McClendon is probably amongst the one or two greatest innovative thinkers and doers in the history of basketball. I mean, he was a teacher first, a coach at 28, started coaching, would bring his players to secretly play against white teams at Duke, you know, versus Brooklyn College, because it was good for these youngsters to learn how to participate, learn not to fear. Most of them never even touched a white guy before, let alone play against them. McClendon created the four corners. He called it two in a corner or jack in the box. And if he did not create the fast break, he refined it to a level that had never been seen before, because you're talking about the early, mid-40s. By later in the decade, his teams were averaging 95 points a game when the average team was scoring 58 points a game. And it was a complicated fast break that he taught to Gaines, that he taught to other great coaches like Ben Jobe, and Jobe became the coach to Avery Johnson, and McClendon coached Sam Jones. McClendon tutored Gaines in the game of basketball. Gaines was a football coach and a football player coming out of Kentucky, goes to Winston-Salem in 1944. Gaines 6'5", 300 pounds, McClendon 5'6", and they used to call themselves Little House and Big House. They actually would go recruiting together in the same car for the same players, no money in the budget. Not unusual for coaches in those days. And they coach many sports at their school. And Gaines, of course, went on to coach great players, great teams. Two in the film, Cleo Hill and Earl Monroe, and Gaines won over 800 games in his career, and like all coaches, so the end of his career was an inglorious end when Fahmy was older and asked to step aside, but he won 828 games, he won a national championship, he won his conference 8 different times. My point is, if he was coaching a majority school, those are numbers and a personality big enough to put him on the cover of Sports Illustrated, but that never happened to him. McClendon is not even in the Hall of Fame as a coach. He's in the Hall of Fame as a contributor.
One of the things McClendon had to deal with that's in the piece is integration and how black players eventually did attend that
majority.
There was an exodus, yeah, that attended these majority schools, and
right.
I wonder what was the impact of this. How did they react, and how was it received?
A complicated question and set of historical and social circumstances. After Brown versus Board of Education was ruled by the court in 1954, there were a number of black teachers, parents, students who had now felt they had an opportunity to go to majority schools, and what would that mean to their lives? So, in terms of college basketball, in the film in Black Magic, I show that through the lives of four great players, youngsters, Elgin Baylor, Oscar Robinson, Bill Russell, and Will Chamberlain, all went to majority schools. By the mid-60s, more and more black kids went to white schools. A big part of the film is a young man named Perry Wallace, who was out of Nashville, was going to go play at Tennessee State, and the last couple of months then decided to go to Vanderbilt. He became the first black player ever to go to an SEC school, Southeastern Conference. 5 years later, even Alabama had decided that the only way to win was to have black players, and they were starting 5 black kids by 72.
Dan, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're going to come back. We have to take a quick break.
Sure.
We're talking with Dan Clores, director and producer of Black Magic, a new documentary that's going to air on ESPN Sunday and Monday. It documents the civil rights movement through the lives of basketball players and coaches who attended historically black colleges and universities. We'll go to your phone calls in just a moment, but we welcome more of them. 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Amundsen Theater, presenting London's most infamous barber back live on stage, slicing up a fiendishly good time in a new production of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. Judy Kaye and David Hess star in the 2005 Tony Award-winning Sweeney Todd. Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, justice will be served. Tickets are now available at the box office or at AmundsenTheater.org.
This is 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Hetty Lynn Hurdies. L.A. City Attorney Rocky Delgadillo announced yesterday he's won $1 million settlement with the owner of two Skid Row hotels. Delgadillo's complaint alleged that landlord Robert Frontiera engaged in what's known as the 28-day shuffle.
Shuffling is the practice of forcing the occupant of a residential hotel out prior to establishing a continuous occupancy of 30 days, to vacate their rooms, and then to immediately re-register. The practice became known as the 28-day shuffle because frequently the forced move would occur at 28 days.
By kicking people out of his hotel every 28 days, Frontiera avoided offering residents the full rights of regular tenants. Under the settlement, Frontiera will pay $200,000 in civil penalties and $700,000 to former and current tenants. It's 1121.
Programming on KPCC is supported by Providence Regional Cancer Centers, committed to the art of healing in the San Fernando and Santa Clarita Valleys. The center's multidisciplinary team of specialists offer a full spectrum of oncology services, including prevention, detection, diagnosis, medical treatment, minimally invasive surgery, clinical research, rehabilitation, patient and caregiver education, and support, with survival rates among the top in the nation. You can get more information at 1-888-HEALING.
And welcome back to the Film Week Hour of Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ted Chen from KNBC, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. In our 11:30 half hour, we will have our reviewers, Gene Oppenheimer and Wade Major, and talk about the new releases for the week. But right now, we're discussing Black Magic, a new two-part film that's going to air on ESPN Sunday and Monday that documents the civil rights movement through the lives of basketball players and coaches who attended historically black colleges and universities. And the producer and director of that film, Dan Cloris, is with us. And Dan, I want to let you continue on the topic in which we were talking about the exodus in the late 60s and early 70s of African-American players from historically black colleges to majority universities, and what impact that it had. And I imagine it was a mixed bag. I mean, you had the goal of integration on the one hand. On the other, you had this depletion of talented players from black colleges and universities.
That's 100% correct. And to all different constituencies, that meant something else. But one of the results was that, the exactly as you said, the allure of the majority institution was very and is very powerful. It represents hugeness, money, more hope in terms of the job force, the economic pull, the allure of greater social life and circles, being on television, being paid more in all the underground ways that college ball players get money, you know, playing in front of domes with 30,000 fans. It's a big deal, and it's not to say that's negative, but as a result, historical black colleges are no longer getting the great high school players. Most of them are playing on a Division II level. They're wonderful players, but they're not great teams anymore. But this is a problem that exists in HBCUs that is bigger than just basketball. You know, enrollment and fundraising is down in many of these schools. So one has to, and people are, of course, confronting this issue on a daily basis, the development and the future of HBCUs.
We're talking to Dan Cloris, director and producer of Black Magic, and we'd welcome your phone calls, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. We especially like to hear from you if you attended historically black college or university. And let's take Chris in the Miracle Mile. Chris, welcome to your talk. Good morning.
Hi, guys. I actually didn't attend a historically black college, but I did. I did handle PR for a coach of a historically black college basketball team in South Carolina a few years ago, and it's interesting you're talking about the mass exodus of coaches and players in during the civil rights era. From my understanding, working with him, I actually wrote an article for him a few years ago for Fox, and it is extremely difficult for black coaches at historically black colleges today to make the transition to upper major programs, the way you talk about it during the civil rights movement. I wonder what your thoughts are on the legitimacy factor of those coaches, because I know that there was a few years ago there was a white coach at Hampton, I believe it was, who was able to make that jump after having a successful he won a tournament game a few years ago. But the black coaches seem to have difficulty gaining legitimacy. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'd like to ask you a question first, anyway, and then I'll answer it. Because South Carolina is a very, very, very big part of my film. I don't know if Ben Jobe is the soul of my film. Does that name ring a bell to you?
No, the coach I worked with was Cy Alexander. He was with South Carolina State.
Well, Cy Alexander, I believe, succeeded. It was a couple of years after Ben Jobe. Ben Jobe at South Carolina State is the soul of the film. He coached there from 68 to 73 and then became the first black assistant under Frank McGuire.
Oh, I see. Okay.
At South Carolina. It's good that you asked that because the end of the film is Jobe's Southern University team in 1993. They play Georgia Tech, the ACC champion in the NCAA playoffs. They're a 25-point underdog, and Southern beats Georgia Tech, the ACC champs, and Bobby Crimmins ends the film by saying that Ben Jobe, and I'm paraphrasing, Ben Jobe was one of the greatest coaches ever. Ben Jobe, but he was black, and in those days, black coaches were not being hired by white schools. Ben Jobe, he could have coached anywhere. He was the perfect coach for a Duke or a North Carolina. That's my answer. These guys were denied the opportunity. It wasn't only Jobe or Gaines or McClendon who did go to a white school in 1966. He was the first black guy to coach Cleveland State. But it was coaches like Cal Irwin and Dave Whitney and many, many, many of these men and women. They just, the doors weren't open to them. Conversely, the coach at Virginia Union since 1978 is a white guy named Dave Robbins. He has won 3 national championships, Division II, at Virginia Union. He continues to coach to this day. He's won over 700 games. He could coach anywhere, could have coached anywhere. But there's a stigma to thinking, oh, they're only coaching at a small black college. It wasn't only coaches. It was players. Earl Monroe averaged 42 a game his senior year in Winston-Salem. They won the national championship. He shot 60% from the field. He revolutionized the game. He wasn't drafted first by the NBA.
Dan.
Detroit Pistons flipped the coin. They picked Jimmy Walker. And they said, it says in the film, the scout, he said, yeah, we don't want him. He played in a little black school.
Dan, Chris raises an interesting point, not only about black coaches from historically black colleges, but there is the continuing issue of the lack of African-American coaches in the NCAA and the NBA, certainly
well,
in proportion
no,
to the number of players.
Is
there? Can you connect the dots there?
No, I think at this point, the NCAA, the schools in the NCAA and the NBA, most everyone is open to a black coach. I mean, you have some teams that only have black coaches, I mean, both in college and pros. I mean, I think where this exists is on the executive level, you know, both within the universities
Certainly.
And somewhat in the NBA. The NBA is a, you know, under Stern's leadership, it's a pretty progressive organization. Basketball, however, one of the points of the film, in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, it's closed to people out of historical black colleges. There's only 7 people in the Hall of Fame with roots from HBCUs, and only 1 for their contributions in those schools, and that's Big House Gaines. They don't even consider these coaches or players, which is sort of a disgrace, actually.
Thank you so much, Dan Cloris, director and producer of Black Magic. It is a 2-part film that airs Sunday and Monday on ESPN. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, Gene Oppenheimer and Wade Major join us in studio to review the week's new movies, including Paranoid Park and Horton Hears a Who.
89.3 KPCC is now broadcasting in HD digital stereo. With a new HD radio receiver, you can listen to our main service and 2 alternative channels, BBC Mundo, the Spanish language news service of the BBC, and The Current, adult alternative music from Minnesota Public Radio. For more information on HD radio, please visit kpcc.org.
Welcome back to the Film Week Hour of Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio, and online at kpcc.org. And we are at our review portion of the program, and joining us in studio to talk about the week's new releases, both in the theater and on DVD, Gene Oppenheimer of Village Voice Media and Wade Major of BoxOffice.com and City Beat. And the first film we're going to talk about is Paranoid Park. It's a movie about teenage skateboarding, which all of us have experience with, right?
Yes, I fall off all the time.
And it's a film about a skateboarder who remains silent about his involvement in the accidental death of a security guard. It stars Gabe Nevins, Taylor Momsen, Dan Liu, Jake Miller, and Lauren McKinney. It's written and directed by Gus Van Sant, based on Blake Nelson's novel. And Wade, you've seen it, and what'd you think?
You know, I actually really liked it. Gus Van Sant has been in a very kind of personal mode since his big studio days, when he did that weird Psycho experiment, Finding Forrester, Good Will Hunting, and then he went into a very personal mode and was making things like Elephant, which won the Cannes Film Festival, and Jerry, which is not so good, and Last Days. This I feel is one of his better personal films. It's a very simple film. It's not very long. It's barely 80 minutes in length, but you're almost inside the lead character's head as much as you're outside. It's more of a personal odyssey. The way you describe it, when you talk to people and say, well, it's about this kid and the security guard dies and he hides that, but it's not really as overt as all that. It's really more about his inner turmoil and how he manages his life in the aftermath. And it's got a lot of Super 8 photography, and it's very gritty, and it's very low budget, and it has a real nice vibe to it.
It's so almost Dream of Consciousness, I thought.
Very much.
And how it does. It starts out with the camera kind of almost floating, following these kids skateboarding. And it's more that it's a skateboarding milieu or subculture rather than being about skateboarding. And I think what Wade said is very true. But to me, I like the story more as the boys seem to feel more. At the beginning, I was just really outside of it. The story reveals itself very slowly, and that's actually is one of the pluses. And once it did reveal itself, that's when I got involved.
Let's go to one of the emotive clips, if you will, from Paranoid Park.
I'd write a letter.
To who?
The person you did it to, like an apology letter, or maybe to someone else, like a separate person. But the point is to get it down and off your chest, and then you can stop stressing.
And what am I supposed to do with the letter after?
Doesn't matter. Like, save it, send it, burn it, you know? The writing it down is the important thing. So, yeah, I mean, once you get it out there, you'll feel way better. It's a big relief.
I don't know, Macy. It sounds like a homework assignment or something.
Trust me, it's not a homework assignment. You know, it just feels good to have it all out.
Yeah, maybe.
But the trick is, write to someone you can really talk to, like someone you're comfortable with, not your parents or your teachers or whatever. Write it to a friend.
Yeah.
Write it to me.
Gene, continue.
Oh, well, that's a clip, and now you know a little bit more what's going on. You hear all the skateboarding. The one thing I want to ask you, Wade, it seemed to me it had very incongruous music. The music was almost
absolutely
pastoral.
Yeah.
You know, not teenage boy music. It was almost kind of dreaming.
Oh, absolutely. Which is one of the things I like so much about it, is that it puts you inside the state of mind, which, you know, movie music tends to sort of magnify what's already obvious, especially in American films. It's like saying, if you didn't get that emotion, well, here's some music to make sure you really get it. And here it's more of a counterpoint. You know, you see the exterior of the character in one way, but the music sort of tells you what's going on inside in a very different way.
Except I didn't really believe that was what was going on inside of him, the music that they ended up using.
To me,
it was much more pastoral, really.
It was, because he's a very passive, kind of pastoral individual. You can tell that it's eating him up inside, but he doesn't have the tools to deal with it.
Yeah.
Gene, where do you see this? I mean, Wade, you touched on this in terms of Gus Van Sant and his trajectory as a filmmaker.
Well, I like the film, but I didn't like it as much as some of his others. I think that the films of his I've liked most were Last Days, which with Michael Pitt, whom we're going to talk about later in another film, which I know Wade hated, but that was a sort of Kurt Cobain. I thought that was wonderful. I also like Drugstore Cowboy and To Die For. I don't like it when he does stuff like Good Will Hunting and those films.
Finding Forrester.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, our next film is Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who. Gosh, that's a tongue twister. It's a CGI adaptation of the Dr. Seuss classic, and the story is about an elephant who hears a cry for help coming from a speck of dust and discovers a tiny civilization in need. And in this clip, Horton, who's played by Jim Carrey, and the mayor of Whoville, who's played by Steve Carell, meet for the first time.
Hello?
Who's there?
This is the mayor.
I knew there was life on this speck.
This speck? What speck?
Well, I don't exactly know how to tell you this, but...
You're living on a speck.
Well, I hate to disagree with you, oh voice from the drainpipe, but I live in Whoville.
Well, then, Whoville's a speck.
Where are you?
Well, from where you're standing, I guess I'm in the sky.
Seriously, who is this? Is this Bert from accounting?
It's Horton Who's the Who is directed by Jimmy Hayward and Steve Martino. Gene?
Well, it's been a long time since I read the book or had it read to me, so I don't remember how much of it actually sticks. But I did like the film, and I was quite nervous going in because I really didn't like Cat in the Hat and How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Now, of course, those were live action rather than computer animated or animated at all. But what I liked about it, actually, is that Jim Carrey did not go overboard. I mean, that's why I was nervous about it, that he was just going to be his usual crazy self. And he wasn't. He was quite restrained. And I ended up really loving Horton's personality and his sweetness and his enthusiasm and this sort of kindness. And I thought that Jim Carrey did a really good job getting that across. I think that there are a few places later in the film that are potentially scary to little kids. Because I'm just doing this as a warning to parents, and I don't remember if this is in the book, but all the townspeople, the Who people, turn against the mayor at one point, and then later they turn against Horton also. The animals in the forest turn against Horton, and they really get quite malicious and try to, you know, kick him and imprison him and stuff, and that could be scary for little kids. So just if you're taking it, you might want to warn them about it.
Because animation is so popular right now, do you think the bar has been raised, and is that a good thing?
I don't like a lot of computer animated stuff unless it's animals. And this was all animals in a sense. And then the people that they have are, of course, you know, little Who people who don't look like people. I thought it was quite cute because Horton and the others, when they talk about each other and the animals, they refer to themselves as people.
And how did Steve Carell do it? I think this is his first voiceover animated film.
I thought he was fine. I thought he was fine.
Yeah, actually, he did the squirrel in Over the Hedge.
Oh, okay,
so this is,
that's right.
Yeah. So he's getting his chops. I didn't see this film, but I remember the original very well, the Chuck Jones television version, which is now on DVD, and it's a wonderful compliment if you want to kind of make a twofer of it.
All right, coming up on our Film Week review portion of Film Week, we're going to talk about the film's Funny Game, starring Naomi Watts and Tim Roth, and also Sleepwalking, starring Nick Stahl and Anna Sophia Robb, directed by William Maher. And we'll discuss them with our critics Gene Oppenheimer of Village Voice Media and Wade Major of BoxOffice.com. You're listening to Film Week on Air Talk. We'll be right back.
Programming on KPCC is supported by the Southern California Mercedes-Benz dealers, offering test drives of their M-Class luxury SUV. Online visitors can build their own bands at mbsocal.com.
We have a giveaway for you on KPCC. It's for a pair of tickets to see Culture Clash in America at the South Coast Repertory, March 16th through April 6th. The Latino Comedy Troupe presents city-specific shows ranging from San Francisco and the Big Apple to Little Cuba. Now they've added Orange County to the mix. Their explosion of ideas bursts forth in every direction with scenes that are political, social, satirical, ethnic, fearless, and hysterical. Variety is called Culture Clash Comic Masters. Tickets available at scr.org. We'll take the third caller at 626-585-7893. U.S. House Democrat Henry Waxman of Los Angeles has issued a subpoena to the Environmental Protection Agency. KPCC's Molly Peterson reports he's aiming to find out more about the agency's reasons for giving California the thumbs down on greenhouse gas regulation.
Waxman heads the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee. Along with the Senate Committee, he's been waiting for the EPA to hand over documentation of its decision. But the agency has blown by several deadlines. So now Waxman is subpoenaing close to 200 documents, and he's giving the agency till next Wednesday to say when it'll hand them over. Waxman and Senator Barbara Boxer, both Democrats, have accused the EPA of stopping California's plan to limit greenhouse gas emissions from cars and trucks for political, not scientific, reasons. This is the second time Waxman's issued a legal order for documents in this case. An earlier order revealed that top EPA staffers knew the agency's eventual decision would open the door wide for a lawsuit. Molly Peterson, 89.3 KPCC.
The verdict expected to be read any minute now in the trial of a wrongful death suit brought by the family of actor John Ritter against a pair of doctors.
What's he called? This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to our Film Week Hour with critics Gene Oppenheimer of Village Voice Media and Wade Major of BoxOffice.com. Our next film is Funny Games. It is about a family that struggles to stay alive when two sociopathic killers invade their home. It stars Naomi Watts, Tim Roth, Brady Corbett, and Devon Gearhart and Michelle Pitt.
Michael Pitt.
Is it Michael Pitt? Yeah. Okay, maybe this is a misspell here. And it's written and directed by Michael Haneke and is rated R. You both have seen it, and I remember reading a piece on this in the LA Times, and it does not sound like an uplifter, Gene.
It's not. This is a film that you, in a sense, need to be warned about so that if you see it, you've really chosen to go see it. It's more of an art house cerebral film. I mean, when you give the description of it, it makes it sound like one of these typical, you know, torture porn. And it's not. It is pornographic, however, to me, in terms of the sadism, the violence. I mean, the film to me is morally reprehensible, partially because it is so convincing.
Haneke is such a frustrating filmmaker. He's almost like a comic book villain. He's somebody I want to grab him, and I just want to say, why can't you use your powers for good? you have so many talents and so many great skills. His film Cachet, which came out several years ago, I thought was just absolutely brilliant. He's an amazingly talented filmmaker. He uses off-screen space, and he uses the frame probably more effectively than any filmmaker since Polanski. He's really gifted. But his movies are so sometimes so sadistic, and this is a remake of probably his most sadistic film, which was originally shot in German in 1997 and starred the late Ulrich Mueller, who starred in the Oscar-winning The Lives of Others. And you watch this film, and it's really hard because you're torn between admiring the craft mm-hmm. and at the same time deploring the fact that this filmmaker is just abusing you. And he's abusing you in the most sadistic way imaginable.
Because it's these two sort of preppy-looking guys who invade these people's home. It's Naomi Watts, who is so good in this film. I mean,
she's extraordinary. Tim Roth is extraordinary. They're all really, really
good. The boy was wonderful, too.
The boy is unbelievable.
Devon Gearhart. But yeah. I kept thinking, how could a director put a child through that? Even though it's just a movie. There are many times where one of the sociopaths, one played by Michael Pitt, turns to the camera and actually talks to the camera.
It's a very Brechtian device. That's what made the original film so kind of controversial at
the
time.
Yes, but
too.
He's doing it because a lot of Haneke's point, I think, in many of his films is how is a comment on society. And I've heard people see this film and say, well, what this is pointless. It's not pointless in that it's his comment on the people watching. Why are you watching this film? Why are you willing to sit and watch this? And so he implicates the audience.
He's daring the audience.
He implicates the audience in ways that is very – I mean, I thought I was going to throw up watching the film, and I spent a couple of days – between being sick and just really crying.
And see, I rebel with movies like this. When I feel that the filmmaker is treating me, the audience, with contempt, that's when I just check out. And I see no reason to sort of sit there and let them indulge in whatever sick fantasies they're indulging. Film critics are far from prudish. The last thing we're going to say is, oh, this should or should not be in a movie. You take a movie as it is. You accept a filmmaker on his or her word. But at the same time, why should I sit there and let someone punch me in the face?
Yes, but that's the whole point. Haneke is saying, why are you sitting there? What's wrong with you? You should get up and walk out because this is such a sadistic, cruel film.
Which is why I have to wonder why Warner Independent decided to make the movie.
Yeah, you're suggesting that he's saying you shouldn't see this film.
That's absolutely...
Don't see my film, and why, if you do, are you here?
I think he's saying something about society, and particularly American society, despite the fact it was done in German first. I think he feels that it will speak much more to Americans who do flock to violence as entertainment.
And indirect criticism of the torture porn films, direct criticism.
I just think as a follow-up to Cachet, which was extraordinary, it's just it's sad.
Okay, we have to move on. We have to move other films. Certainly not recommendations for Funny Games. Sleepwalking is about,
a partial one.
Okay. Sleepwalking is about a young man and his 11-year-old niece who bond after her mother abandons her. And in this scene, Tara, played by Anna Sophia Robb, and her uncle James, played by Nick Stahl, discuss their next move over lunch at a diner.
$315.
Really?
That's not that much.
How far could we go?
I know, I'll figure it out.
We could go to Mexico. Isn't that where you go in this sort of situation?
Mexico?
Yeah, like in the movies.
I don't think we have enough to get that far.
Well, we need fake names. You know, so we don't get caught. I'll be Nicole, and I want to be 13 years old. Because being 12 is stupid.
Sleepwalking also stars Charlize Theron, Woody Harrelson, and Dennis Hopper, and is directed by William Maher. Wade?
You know, it's a really well-intentioned film. I don't feel like it ever really quite gets its narrative groove. You're watching actors do their best with dialogue that sort of it's very elliptical. It wants to be a better film than I think it really ultimately is. And I was rooting for it. You know, this is released by Overture Films, which is the new distribution company from Chris McGurk and Starz Media. And I'm pulling for every independent distributor that has no ties to a studio out there because we need them. But it just doesn't really deliver the goods. It kind of meanders, and it never really pulls.
It doesn't seem authentic.
It doesn't.
That, to me, was the big problem. Even the sets. I mean, when you go to the farmhouse, Dennis Hopper's farmhouse, it looks like it was painted that color to look very weathered. And I think that Nick Stahl's a fabulous actor, and I really didn't buy him here.
No.
Charlize Theron, I thought, was good. I thought that the girl, Rob... to me, it felt like she was acting.
It needed more Woody Harrelson, and it needed more Dennis Hopper.
The inauthenticity, if you will, does that fall on the writer, Zach Stanford? Does it fall on the director?
Perhaps the director, and writing, I think.
Both the director and the writer. The writer had some sort of half-formed ideas that he thought might be fleshed out if he kind of inserted it into a road trip. Road trip movies tend to be an excuse for a lot of writers, and in this case, I think it was.
Let's go to our next film, Snow Angels. It's about three couples and their stories and how they intertwine and are affected by an unforeseen tragedy. It stars Sam Rockwell, Kate Beckinsale, Nikki Catt, and Griffin Dunn. It's written and directed by David Gordon Green, based on the novel by Stuart Onan. Jean?
Well, David Gordon Green's first film, George Washington, is one of the best debut films I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
And to varying degrees, I have been disappointed with everything else he has done, although I think that, you know, each film has something to recommend it. What this film has to recommend it is two performances by Michael Angarano and Olivia Thirlby, who play the teenage couple, and they are the only characters in this film that I related to, that I cared about. You have Kate Beckinsale and Sam Rockwell who are separated, and he's trying to get back with her. She doesn't want to. He seemed almost like mentally challenged. He's supposed to be fragile. He's tried to commit suicide. I could have never seen them together. At one point she says, he used to make me laugh. He made me feel beautiful. Well, guess what, Kate Beckinsale? You are gorgeous. I mean, you don't have, you know. And so I didn't buy all of that. But the teenagers, those two characters, I thought were just fabulous.
This is a case of having a novel that probably works very well as a novel and not quite so well as a film. The story seems to want to be in the sweet hereafter vein. It wants to put you into this cold, rural, and very remote environment and immerse you in the tragedy of these people. But David Gordon Green is probably not the right director for this. He's good with actors. He's very good with actors. But he has a very leisurely, lapping pace to his movies that a movie of this nature needs to be a little more brisk, and it needs to be a little tighter, and it needs to throb a little more.
Let's go to our next film, which is Never Back Down. It is a mixed martial arts teen drama. It stars Sean Ferris, Amber Heard, and Jaimin Onsu, and is directed by Jeff Wadlow and written by Chris Hoddy. And in this scene, Jake, played by Sean Ferris, learns a lesson from his coach, Gene, played by Jaimin Onsu.
Okay, you win.
I get it.
But you can't always change position.
I mean, sometimes you just get stuck.
In any fight, you can always change your position. You just have to find a way.
So it's on me?
Always has been. Always.
Wade, what'd you think?
Ted, tell me if you've heard this plot before. There's a troubled kid, single mom, new town. He gets into the new school, likes a girl. Girl's boyfriend is a martial arts guy. He gets in trouble, needs to go find a mentor to teach him how to fight so he can win the big fight at the end.
Have you heard that? Just talk about Good Will Hunting, although there's no fighting.
No, it's the Karate Kid. It's verbatim the Karate Kid inserted into this world of Fight Club and UFC with ripped abs and you know, all these really hunky teenagers. It's just a deplorable mess. I really wanted to talk about this because despite the fact that no one who listens to KPCC will go see this movie, and no one who...
Not even with Jaimin Onsu in it?
No, not even with Jaimin Onsu in it. And no one who would go see this movie probably even knows that KPCC exists. But this to me represents...
I think we have our young listeners.
Well, you have intelligent listeners. That's the difference. This to me represents the most reprehensible part of Hollywood filmmaking, this idea that if we make stupid movies for teenagers based on time-worn formulas, they will come and we don't need to cater to anyone else. It's just the most brain-dead, awful film. It's badly written, badly directed, and it has no reason to exist.
But other than that, you liked it.
Oh, it's just so deplorable.
Okay. Well, let's go to our next film, which is The Unforeseen. The story is about a conflict between a Texas real estate developer and the local community that fights back when his residential development threatens a local natural treasure. It's directed by Laura Dunn and features interviews with Robert Redford, Willie Nelson, and the late Texas Governor Ann Richards, and the environmentalist Wendell Berry. And Gene, you've seen it.
Yeah, this is a really impressive documentary and very sad in a way to watch. This took place in Texas outside Austin, and there was a beautiful swimming hole. It was an aquifer. Beautiful. I mean, people use it all the time. They go swimming. They go picnicking. The town of Austin, the people around there love it. And a developer came in the 80s and said, I want to turn this country into a big development. And the citizens were very upset and protested. There's a wonderful, inspiring section of this film where there's a city council hearing. And the people stay all night. There are 800 people who are testifying against having this project come in. And then what happens, of course, is that the legislature, this is, you know, private, you know, financial interests and politicians, particularly in Texas, but probably everywhere, and I'm from Texas, who then decide to not listen to what the citizens have said, and they vote to change, to allow the developer to build. Ann Richards, the governor at the time, vetoed it, wouldn't let them. Well, the next time she ran, she was George Bush came in, and he immediately approved it. And all what the citizens thought happened, it became almost like a drainage ditch. I mean, the whole place is just polluted now and terrible. And it's just a wonderful story about documentary about what we are doing to our land and to our environment. And to its credit, it does not make the developer a really bad person. He grew up in a farm. He ended up leaving the farm because it was very hard to make a living, blah, blah, blah. So it's interesting from a lot of different points of view.
But it sounds like it highlights the complicitness between developers and politicians. And
yes,
that's something
I mean,
universal. It's not
right,
just Texas.
Right, absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much, Gene. Let's talk about All in This Tea, which is our next film, a foreign film and documentary about an American tea importer, David Lee Hoffman, who travels to some of the world's most remote regions of China. Some of the most remote regions of China in search of the finest handmade teas in the world. And Wade, you've seen it. And what do you think? It was directed by Les Blank and Gina Lebrecht.
Yeah, and Les Blank is a real documentary fixture. He's just been so prolific. He's most famous for his Werner Herzog films. Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe, which is a very bizarre little micro doc from some years ago. And, of course, Burden of Dreams, the story of the making of Fitzcarraldo. He deals very well with obsessives. He makes good movies about obsessives. And I am not a tea drinker. And so I found this to be absolutely fascinating, not just from the perspective of how he tracks down these remote teas and these remote farmers who have these ancient ways of that have been handed down through the generations, but when you get into the political conflict, trying to convince the Chinese government that it behooves everyone to export these teas as opposed to the manufactured big corporate teas. That's when it got really interesting to me.
Well, that part was interesting, but I am a rabid tea drinker. I drink 10, 12, 15 cups of tea a day, and I found this really boring.
Interesting. The tea lover didn't like it.
No, I didn't. I mean, it doesn't really show – all it does is show this guy going around smelling the tea, talking to the farmers. It doesn't say how he gets it.
And I know nothing about tea, and I feel like I know everything about tea now.
I have a doctorate in tea.
Maybe it's an advantage if you aren't a tea lover and don't know much about teas. Maybe you'll find it more interesting.
Could be.
Okay, let's go to our next film, which is Beaufort. It's also a foreign film, and it's about the final days of 2000, marking the end of a young Israeli army unit's withdrawal from an ancient fortress in South Lebanon. And I believe it was an Academy Award.
It was Oscar nominated this year, yes.
Starring Oshri Cohen, Ite Tehran, Eli Eltonio. I'm probably butchering all these names, and directed and co-written by Joseph Cedar, based on a true story and Ron Lesham's novel. And Wade, you've seen it.
Yeah, I think this is a very good film. It's not a perfect film. It probably deserved its Oscar nomination. I haven't seen the other nominees, but what's interesting is that Joseph Cedar, the director, is a Hasidic Jew, and he is a veteran of this exact conflict with Lebanon that lasted for 18 some years, and or basically with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And you know, there are a lot of movies, these guys at an outpost movies that we've had for since time immemorial. I think this really stands kind of at the head of that group. I thought the psychology was interesting, the collision of different sensibilities among these soldiers as they're getting ready to evacuate this fort, and the fact that war, even when it's ending, it goes right up until the last second, the very last second. It's still war. That I thought very interesting.
I agree with Wade for about the first half hour of the film, or 40 minutes, and then it's the same thing over and over and over again. It doesn't really go anywhere. I think it makes its point early on. And then I'd be happy if it had just been like an hour and a half film.
It should have been about an hour and a half film. I think it makes its points very succinctly throughout, but there are large stretches where it really draws those points out.
And it's interesting not only in terms of what's going on in Israel and the Middle East, but even what's going on in Iraq, because it's like, you know, at one time everybody was willing to give their life for it, and now it seems it's pointless losing all those lives.
I remember reading one review saying it was essentially apolitical, but I also interviewed
Joseph Cedar.
Yes, at the Oscars, and he said it's very political.
Yeah.
So what was your
political.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's very political, but if you're not Israeli, I think you miss some of that.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gene Oppenheimer and Wade Major. You're listening to Film Week on Air Talk. Have a terrific Friday, everyone.